Welcome to the podcast series for AJP Heart and Circulatory Physiology. I'm your host, Kara Hansel-Kean. Today we'll discuss the article by Pizzuto et al. Titled, Telemetry, Hibernating Myocardium, and Sudden Death. This article published online April 12, 2013. My guests today are Associate Editor Fabio Recchia, Lead Author John Canty, and Expert Ed McFalls. Let's get started.
Thank you, Kara. Approximately 30% of the victims of sudden cardiac death do not display macroscopic coronary lesions or signs of coronary occlusion. Therefore, the identification of subjects at risk of sudden cardiac death with no previous history of cardiac ischemia remains a major clinical challenge. The pathophysiological basis of this phenomenon is poorly understood, mainly due to the difficulty of collecting insightful functional data in humans immediately before the occurrence of ventricular fibrillation or arrest. Reliable and clinically relevant animal models are therefore absolutely needed to explore in detail the triggering factors. The authors of the present study developed a technically demanding pig model prone to spontaneous sudden cardiac death. The animals were chronically instrumented with sensors to monitor telemetrically electrocardiographic and left ventricular pressure changes for months. The investigators could then obtain precious information relative to the instance preceding the fatal event. John, what are the key findings of your study and how will they impact the current strategies for the prevention of sudden cardiac death?
Well, Fabio, for a long time we've been wondering what the relationship between myocardial ischemia and the development of lethal ventricular arrhythmias actually is, because many patients who have sudden death have underlying coronary artery disease that's severe, but frequently have no evidence of acute myocardial infarction or thrombus. And so by using telemetry in a model of coronary disease that's associated with spontaneous VTVF, we were able to determine the frequency and duration of conventional indices of myocardial ischemia. Quite surprisingly, prior to the development of VTVF, we found no warning arrhythmias in these animals. Basically, the electrocardiographic evidence of ST depression was very uncommon in these animals prior to the development of ventricular tachycardia that degenerated into ventricular fibrillation. But what was interesting was when we did telemetry of hemodynamics, left ventricular end diastolic pressure would frequently transiently increase during periods that you would predict would be associated with stress-induced ischemia. These episodes, though, at the time of sudden death, were no different than the ones that were occurring daily in terms of surviving animals. And so we don't really have any evidence that the severity of ischemia per se was worse in the animals that developed lethal arrhythmias than those that survived. And the duration of ischemia was so brief that it did not persist long enough to get electrocardiographic evidence of myocardial ischemia.
Thank you, John. Ed, would you like to comment on the strengths and, if any, the limitations of this study?
John, I think it was a great study, and clinically, it has enormous implications. And I'll go back a little bit. Some classic studies, Marcel DeCarli at the UCLA group showed that hibernating hearts are a bad thing if not revascularized, and there's a high incidence of sudden death. And I think what John's work is showing that at some level, some arrhythmias that are lethal may be triggered by some ischemic event. And by that, when I read the article, end diastolic pressures are going up during this sympathetic discharge. QT intervals are shortening, almost like calcium is entering the cell. And it raises the question at some level during a supply-demand mismatch, maybe through collateral blood flow, that there was an ischemic trigger, albeit not detected by the telemetry. And that has important implications for hibernating hearts in patients who may not have an ischemic cardiomyopathy, but may be subjected to some level of a brief ischemic stress and sudden death. And so my one question through John would be, where is the role of revascularization? And I know you've done that in the past, but is that something that might interrupt at some level the incidence of sudden death in this presumably collateral-dependent hibernating heart tissue?
Well, I think it would. And as you know, clinically, revascularization has a very potent, favorable effect on reducing sudden cardiac death.
Another question, John, I had is, and I will say that Dirk Dunker from Erasmus has shown changes in the microvasculature related to endothelin receptors, whether you think that we could pharmacologically attack the resistance vessels as some additional intervention, and maybe you could comment on that.
It's possible. I think Dirk's demonstrated there have been microcirculatory changes in the chronically ischemic heart. We see those as well. And what we know, though, in terms of pharmacologic vasodilation is that, at least in the subendocardium, these vessels are critically vasodilated. And in terms of some studies we haven't published yet, don't look to be at least initially impaired after revascularization to pharmacologic stimuli.
The one interesting observation that Jim Falavlido through the same lab has made is that there's denervation using C11 ephedrine. That is, hibernating hearts tend to be denervated. And even with revascularization, and John has shown this 2 or 3 years ago in an interesting paper, it raises the question, what is going on in the denervated heart that might subject the heart to a pro-arrhythmic substrate? And maybe you could comment on that.
Yeah, well, I think the other things that are associated with ischemia-induced denervation are downregulation and beta receptor density. So it's maybe not the denervation per se that's the problem, but it's the inhomogeneity and sympathetic innervation, beta adrenergic receptor responsiveness, and also cellular morphology where there's cellular hypertrophy in these chronically ischemic zones. But what I think is really intriguing about this and what we've really demonstrated, I think, for the first time is those of us in clinical cardiology have realized for a number of years that many episodes of myocardial ischemia in patients with coronary disease are asymptomatic, close to 80%, and we call that silent myocardial ischemia. What this study begins to raise is that if we accept left ventricular end diastolic pressure as a sensitive measure of subendocardial ischemia, which it clearly is, and when we take people into the cardiac catheterization laboratory, we have another form of what's called silent ischemia that's electrocardiographically silent. And what it really means is that a lot of these ischemia-induced changes from reversible ischemia, whether it's due to programmed cell death leading to myocyte hypertrophy or regional sympathetic denervation, can be ongoing in completely asymptomatic patients and could explain why sudden cardiac death can be the first and only manifestation of people dying heart disease. So that, to me, is really what the most exciting part of this is.
I guess playing off your prior work and something that's extremely timely is the utility of cell-based therapies. There are two or three important clinical trials that are suggesting that outcomes are improved with cell-based therapies. And you yourself have shown that there may be an incremental gain in giving mesenchymal stem cells. Do you see any role in using cell-based therapies as some way to avert this arrhythmogenic potential?
Well, it's a good question, Ed. I think right now, with the sample sizes we have, all we can really say is that there isn't a major signal, either in terms of a benefit or a deleterious effect of intracoronary mesenchymal stem cells in this model. It doesn't have a profound effect on the incidence of arrhythmic death, nor does it seem to increase it. But we've also done sample size analysis to really see an effect that would reduce the rate by 10% would require you to do a study in close to 100 animals.
Thank you, John. Thank you, Ed, for this interesting and insightful discussion. Kara?
You've been listening to an AJP Heart and Circ podcast. For more podcasts, visit us online at ajpheart.physiology.org. Thank you.